Chapter 3. What it is like to travel in a celestial coffin was a thing that Ransom never described. He said he couldn't. But odd hints about that journey have come out at one time or another when he was talking of quite different matters. According to his own account, he was not what we call conscious, and yet at the same time the experience was a very positive one, with a quality of its own. On one occasion, someone had been talking about seeing life in the popular sense of knocking about the world and getting to know people, and B, who was present, and who is an anthroposophist, said something I can't quite remember about seeing life in a very different sense. I think he was referring to some system of meditation which claimed to make the form of life itself visible to the inner eye. At any rate, Ransom let himself in for a long cross-examination by failing to conceal the fact that he attached some very definite idea to this. He even went so far, under extreme pressure, as to say that life appeared to him in that condition as a coloured shape. Asked what colour, he gave a curious look and could only say, "What colours? Yes, what colours?" But then he spoiled it all by adding, "Of course it wasn't colour at all, really, I mean not what we'd call colour," and shutting up completely for the rest of the evening. Another hint came out when a sceptical friend of ours called McPhee was arguing against the Christian doctrine of the resurrection of the human body. I was his victim at the moment, and he was pressing on me in his Scots way with such questions as, "So you think you're going to have guts and palate forever in a world where there'll be no eating, and genital organs in a world without copulation? Man, you'll have a grand time of it." When Ransom suddenly burst out with great excitement, "Oh, don't you see, you ass, that there's a difference between a transsensuous life and a non-sensuous life?" That, of course, directed McPhee's fire to him. What emerged was that in Ransom's opinion, the present functions and appetites of the body would disappear, not because they were atrophied, but because they were, as he said, engulfed. He used the word transsexual, I remember, and began to hunt about for some similar words to apply to eating, after rejecting transgastronomic, and since he was not the only philologist present, that diverted the conversation into different channels. But I am pretty sure he was thinking of something he had experienced on his voyage to Venus. But perhaps the most mysterious thing he ever said about it was this. I was questioning him on the subject, which he doesn't often allow, and had incautiously said, "Of course I realize it's all rather too vague for you to put into words," when he took me up rather sharply for such a patient man by saying, "On the contrary, it is words that are vague. The reason why the thing can't be expressed is that it's too definite for language." And that is about all I can tell you of his journey. One thing is certain, that he came back from Venus even more changed than he had come back from Mars. But of course, that may have been because of what happened to him after his landing. To that landing, as Ransom narrated it to me, I will now proceed. He seems to have been awakened, if that is the right word, from his indescribable celestial state by the sensation of falling. In other words, when he was near enough to Venus to feel Venus as something in the downward direction. The next thing he noticed was that he was very warm on one side and very cold on the other, though neither sensation was so extreme as to be really painful. Anyway, both were soon swallowed up in the prodigious white light from below, which began to penetrate through the semi-opaque walls of the casket. This steadily increased and became distressing in spite of the fact that his eyes were protected. There is no doubt this was the albedo, the outer veil of very dense atmosphere with which Venus is surrounded and which reflects the sun's rays with intense power. For some obscure reason, he was not conscious, as he had been on his approach to Mars, of his own rapidly increasing weight. When the white light was just about to become unbearable, it disappeared altogether, and very soon after, the cold on his left side and the heat on his right began to decrease and to be replaced by an equable warmth. I take it he was now in the outer layer of the Perelandrian atmosphere, at first in a pale and later in a tinted twilight. The prevailing colour, as far as he could see through the sides of the casket, was golden or coppery. By this time he must have been very near the surface of the planet, with the length of the casket at right angles to that surface, falling feet downwards like a man in a lift. The sensation of falling, helpless as he was and unable to move his arms, became frightening. Then suddenly there came a great green darkness, an unidentifiable noise, the first message from the new world, and a marked drop in temperature. He seemed now to have assumed a horizontal position, and also, to his great surprise, to be moving not downwards, but upwards, though at the moment he judged this to be an illusion. All this time he must have been making faint, unconscious efforts to move his limbs, for now he suddenly found that the sides of his prison house yielded to pressure. He was moving his limbs, encumbered with some viscous substance. Where was the casket? His sensations were very confused. Sometimes he seemed to be falling, sometimes to be soaring upwards, and then again to be moving in the horizontal plane. The viscous substance was white. There seemed to be less of it every moment. White, cloudy stuff, just like the casket, only not solid. With a horrible shock, he realized that it was the casket. The casket melting, dissolving away, giving place to an indescribable confusion of color. A rich, varied world in which nothing, for the moment, seemed palpable. There was no casket now. He was turned out, deposited, solitary. He was in Perelandra. His first impression was of nothing more definite than of something slanted, as though he were looking at a photograph which had been taken when the camera was not held level. And even this lasted for only an instant. The slant was replaced by a different slant. Then two slants rushed together and made a peak, and the peak flattened suddenly into a horizontal line, and the horizontal line tilted and became the edge of a vast gleaming slope which rushed furiously towards him. At the same moment he felt that he was being lifted. Up and up he soared, till it seemed as if he must reach the burning dome of gold that hung above him instead of a sky. Then he was at a summit. But almost before his glance had taken in a huge valley that yawned beneath him, shining green like glass and marbled with streaks of scummy white, he was rushing down into that valley at perhaps 30 miles an hour. And now he realized that there was a delicious coolness over every part of him, except his head, that his feet rested on nothing, and that he had for some time been performing unconsciously the actions of a swimmer. He was riding the foamless swell of an ocean, fresh and cool after the fierce temperatures of heaven, but warm by earthly standards, as warm as a shallow bay with sandy bottom in a subtropical climate. As he rushed smoothly up the great convex hillside of the next wave, he got a mouthful of the water. It was hardly at all flavored with salt. It was drinkable, like fresh water, and only by an infinitesimal degree less insipid. Though he had not been aware of thirst till now, his drink gave him a quite astonishing pleasure. It was almost like meeting pleasure itself for the first time. He buried his flushed face in the green translucence, and when he withdrew it, found himself once more on the top of a wave. There was no land in sight. The sky was pure, flat gold, like the background of a medieval picture. It looked very distant, as far off as a cirrus cloud looks from Earth. The ocean was gold, too, in the offing, flecked with innumerable shadows. The nearer waves, though golden where their summits caught the light, were green on their slopes, first emerald, and lower down a lustrous bottle green, deepening to blue where they passed beneath the shadow of other waves. All this he saw in a flash. Then he was speeding down once more into the trough. He had somehow turned onto his back. He saw the golden roof of that world quivering with a rapid variation of paler lights, as a ceiling quivers at the reflected sunlight from the bathwater when you step into your bath on a summer morning. He guessed that this was the reflection of the waves wherein he swam. It is a phenomenon observable 3 days out of 5 in the planet of love. The queen of those seas views herself continually in a celestial mirror. Up again to the crest, and still no sight of land. Something that looked like clouds, or could it be ships, far away on his left. Then down, 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 he thought he would never reach the end of it. This time he noticed how dim the light was. Such tepid revelry in water, such glorious bathing, as one would have called it on earth, suggested as its natural accompaniment a blazing sun. But here there was no such thing. The water gleamed, the sky burned with gold, but all was rich and dim, and his eyes fed upon it undazzled and unaching. The very names of green and gold which he had used perforce in describing the scene are too harsh for the tenderness, the muted iridescence of that warm, maternal, delicately gorgeous world. It was mild to look upon as evening, warm like summer noon, gentle and winning like early dawn. It was altogether pleasurable. He sighed. There was a wave ahead of him now so high that it was dreadful. We speak idly in our own world of seas mountain-high when they are not much more than mast-high. But this was the real thing. If the huge shape had been a hill of land and not of water, he might have spent a whole forenoon or longer walking the slope before he reached the summit. It gathered him into itself and hurled him up to that elevation in a matter of seconds. But before he reached the top, he almost cried out in terror, for this wave had not a smooth top like the others. A horrible crest appeared, jagged and billowy, and fantastic shapes, unnatural, even unliquid in appearance, sprouted from the ridge. Rocks? Foam? Beasts? The question hardly had time to flash through his mind before the thing was upon him. Involuntarily he shut his eyes. Then he found himself once more rushing downhill. Whatever it was had gone past him. But it had been something. He had been struck in the face. Dabbing with his hands, he found no blood. He had been struck by something soft which did him no harm, but merely stung like a lash because of the speed at which he met it. He turned around on his back again, already, as he did so, soaring thousands of feet aloft to the high water of the next ridge. Far down below him, in a vast, momentary valley, he saw the thing that had missed him. It was an irregularly shaped object with many curves and re-entrance. It was variegated in colour, like a patchwork quilt, flame colour, ultramarine, crimson, orange, gamboge, and violet. He could not say more about it, for the whole glimpse lasted so short a time. Whatever the thing was, it was floating, for it rushed up the slope of the opposite wave and over the summit and out of sight. It sat to the water like a skin, curving as the water curved. It took the wave's shape at the top, so that for a moment half of it was already out of sight beyond the ridge, and the other half still lying on the hither slope. It behaved rather like a mat of weeds on a river, a mat of weeds that takes on every contour of the little ripples you make by rowing past it, but on a very different scale. This thing might have been 30 acres or more in area. Words are slow. You must not lose sight of the fact that his whole life on Venus up till now had lasted less than 5 minutes. He was not in the least tired, and not yet seriously alarmed as to his power of surviving in such a world. He had confidence in those who had sent him there, and, for the meantime, the coolness of the water and the freedom of his limbs were still a novelty and a delight. But more than all these was something else at which I have already hinted, and which can hardly be put into words. The strange sense of excessive pleasure which seemed somehow to be communicated to him through all his senses at once. I use the word excessive because Ransom himself could only describe it by saying that, for his first few days on Perelandra, he was haunted not by a feeling of guilt, but by surprise that he had no such feeling. There was an exuberance or prodigality of sweetness about the mere act of living which our race finds it difficult not to associate with forbidden and extravagant actions. Yet it is a violent world, too. Hardly had he lost sight of the floating object when his eyes were stabbed by an unendurable light. A grading blue to violet illumination made the golden sky seem dark by comparison, and in a moment of time revealed more of the new planet than he had yet seen. He saw the waste of waves spread illimitably before him, and far, far away at the very end of the world, against the sky, a single smooth column of ghastly green standing up, the one thing fixed and vertical in this universe of shifting slopes. Then the rich twilight rushed back, now seeming almost darkness, and he heard thunder. But it has a different timbre from the terrestrial thunder, more resonance, and even, when distant, a kind of tinkling. It is the laugh, rather than the roar of heaven. Another flash followed, and another, and then the storm was all about him. Enormous purple clouds came driving between him and the golden sky, and with no preliminary drops, a rain such as he had never experienced began to fall. There were no lines in it. The water above him seemed only less continuous than the sea, and he found it difficult to breathe. The flashes were incessant. In between them, when he looked in any direction except that of the clouds, he saw a completely changed world. It was like being at the center of a rainbow, or in a cloud of multicolored steam. The water which now filled the air was turning sea and sky into a bedlam of flaming and writhing transparencies. He was dazzled, and now for the first time a little frightened. In the flashes he saw, as before, only the endless sea and the still green column at the end of the world. No land anywhere. Not the suggestion of a shore from one horizon to the other. The thunder was ear-splitting, and it was difficult to get enough air. All sorts of things seemed to be coming down in the rain, living things, apparently. They looked like preternaturally airy and graceful frogs, sublimated frogs, and had the colour of dragonflies. But he was in no plight to make careful observations. He was beginning to feel the first symptoms of exhaustion, and was completely confused by the riot of colours in the atmosphere. How long this state of affairs lasted he could not say, but the next thing that he remembers noticing with any accuracy was that the swell was decreasing. He got the impression of being near the end of a range of water mountains and looking down into lower country. For a long time he never reached this lower country. What had seemed, by comparison with the seas he had met on his first arrival, to be calm water, always turned out to be only slightly smaller waves when he rushed down into them. There seemed to be a good many of the big floating objects about, and these, again, from some distance, looked like an archipelago. But always, as he drew nearer and found the roughness of the water they were riding, they became more like a fleet. But in the end there was no doubt that the swell was subsiding. The rain stopped. The waves were merely of Atlantic height. The rainbow colours grew fainter and more transparent, and the golden sky first showed timidly through them and then established itself again from horizon to horizon. The waves grew smaller still. He began to breathe freely. But he was now really tired and beginning to find leisure to be afraid. One of the great patches of floating stuff was sidling down a wave not more than a few hundred yards away. He eyed it eagerly, wondering whether he could climb onto one of these things for rest. He strongly suspected that they would prove mere mats of weed or the topmost branches of submarine forests, incapable of supporting him. But while he thought this, the particular one on which his eyes were fixed crept up a wave and came between him and the sky. It was not flat. From its tawny surface a whole series of feathery and billowy shapes arose, very unequal in height. They looked darkish against the dim glow of the golden roof. Then they all tilted one way as the thing which carried them curled over the crown of the water and dipped out of sight. But here was another, not 30 yards away, and bearing down on him. He struck out towards it, noticing as he did so how sore and feeble his arms were, and feeling his first thrill of true fear. As he approached it, he saw that it ended in a fringe of undoubtedly vegetable matter. It trailed, in fact, a dark red skirt of tubes and strings and bladders. He grabbed at them and found he was not yet near enough. He began swimming desperately, for the thing was gliding past him at some 10 miles an hour. He grabbed again and got a handful of whip-like red strings, but they pulled out of his hand and almost cut him. Then he thrust himself right in among them, snatching wildly straight before him. For 1 second he was in a kind of vegetable broth of gurgling tubes and exploding bladders. Next moment, his hands caught something firmer ahead, something almost like very soft wood. Then, with the breath nearly knocked out of him and a bruised knee, he found himself lying face downward on a resistant surface. He pulled himself an inch or so further. Yes, there was no doubt now, one did not go through. It was something one could lie on. It seems that he must have remained lying on his face, doing nothing and thinking nothing for a very long time. When he next began to take any notice of his surroundings, he was, at all events, well rested. His first discovery was that he lay on a dry surface, which, on examination, turned out to consist of something very like heather, except for the colour, which was coppery. Burrowing idly with his fingers, he found something friable, like dry soil, but very little of it, for almost at once he came upon a base of tough, interlocked fibres. Then he rolled round on his back, and in doing so discovered the extreme resilience of the surface on which he lay. It was something much more than the pliancy of the heather-like vegetation, and felt more as if the whole floating island beneath that vegetation were a kind of mattress. He turned and looked inland, if that is the right word, and for one instant what he saw looked very like a country. He was looking up a long, lonely valley with a copper-coloured floor bordered on each side by gentle slopes, closed in a kind of many-coloured forest. But even as he took this in, it became a long, copper-coloured ridge, with the forest sloping down on each side of it. Of course he ought to have been prepared for this, but he says that it gave him an almost sickening shock. The thing had looked, in that first glance, so like a real country that he had forgotten it was floating. An island, if you like, with hills and valleys, but hills and valleys which changed places every minute, so that only a cinematograph could make a contour map of it. And that is the nature of the floating islands of Perelandra. A photograph, omitting the colours and the perpetual variation of shape, would make them look deceptively like landscapes on our own world. But the reality is very different, for they are dry and fruitful like land, but their only shape is the inconstant shape of the water beneath them. Yet the land-like appearance proved hard to resist. Although he had now grasped with his brain what was happening, Ransom had not yet grasped it with his muscles and nerves. He rose to take a few paces inland and downhill, as it was at the moment of his rising, and immediately found himself flung down on his face, unhurt because of the softness of the weed. He scrambled to his feet, saw that he now had a steep slope to ascend, and fell a second time. A blessed relaxation of the strain in which he had been living since his arrival dissolved him into weak laughter. He rolled to and fro on the soft, fragrant surface in a real schoolboy fit of the giggles. This passed, and then for the next hour or two he was teaching himself to walk. It was much harder than getting your sea legs on a ship, for whatever the sea is doing, the deck of the ship remains a plane. But this was like learning to walk on water itself. It took him several hours to get 100 yards away from the edge or coast of the floating island, and he was proud when he could go 5 paces without a fall. Arms outstretched, knees bent in readiness for sudden change of balance, his whole body swaying and tense like that of one who is learning to walk the tightrope. Perhaps he would have learned more quickly if his falls had not been so soft, if it had not been so pleasant, having fallen, to lie still and gaze at the golden roof and hear the endless soothing noise of the water and breathe in the curiously delightful smell of the herbage. And then, too, it was so strange, after rolling head over heels down into some little dell, to open his eyes and find himself seated on the central mountain peak of the whole island, looking down like Robinson Crusoe on field and forest to the shores in every direction, that a man could hardly help sitting there a few minutes longer, and then being detained again because, even as he made to rise, mountain and valley alike had been obliterated and the whole island had become a level plain. At long last he reached the wooded part. There was an undergrowth of feathery vegetation, about the height of gooseberry bushes, coloured like sea anemones. Above this were the taller growths, strange trees with tube-like trunks of grey and purple, spreading rich canopies above his head, in which orange, silver and blue were the predominant colours. Here, with the aid of the tree trunks, he could keep his feet more easily. The smells in the forest were beyond all that he had ever conceived. To say that they made him feel hungry and thirsty would be misleading. Almost, they created a new kind of hunger and thirst, a longing that seemed to flow over from the body into the soul, and which was a heaven to feel. Again and again he stood still, clinging to some branch to steady himself, and breathed it all in, as if breathing had become a kind of ritual. And at the same time the forest landscape furnished what would have been a dozen landscapes on earth. Now level wood with trees as vertical as towers, now a deep bottom where it was surprising not to find a stream, now a wood growing on a hillside, and now again a hilltop, whence one looked down through slanted boles at the distant sea. Save for the inorganic sound of waves, there was utter silence about him. The sense of his solitude became intense without becoming at all painful, only adding, as it were, a last touch of wildness to the unearthly pleasures that surrounded him. If he had any fear now, it was a faint apprehension that his reason might be in danger. There was something in Perelandra that might overload a human brain. Now he had come to a part of the wood where great globes of yellow fruit hung from the trees, clustered as toy balloons are clustered on the back of the balloon man, and about the same size. He picked one of them and turned it over and over. The rind was smooth and firm and seemed impossible to tear open. Then, by accident, one of his fingers punctured it and went through into coldness. After a moment's hesitation, he put the little aperture to his lips. He had meant to extract the smallest experimental sip, but the first taste put his caution all to flight. It was, of course, a taste, just as his thirst and hunger had been thirst and hunger. But then it was so different from every other taste that it seemed mere pedantry to call it a taste at all. It was like the discovery of a totally new genus of pleasures, something unheard of among men, out of all reckoning, beyond all covenant. For one draught of this on earth, wars would be fought and nations betrayed. It could not be classified. He could never tell us when he came back to the world of men whether it was sharp or sweet, savoury or voluptuous, creamy or piercing. Not like that, was all he could ever say to such inquiries. As he let the empty gourd fall from his hand and was about to pluck a second one, it came into his head that he was now neither hungry nor thirsty. And yet to repeat a pleasure so intense and almost so spiritual seemed an obvious thing to do. His reason, or what we commonly take to be reason in our own world, was all in favour of tasting this miracle again. The childlike innocence of fruit, the labours he had undergone, the uncertainty of the future, all seemed to commend the action. Yet something seemed opposed to this reason. It is difficult to suppose that this opposition came from desire, for what desire would turn from so much deliciousness? But, for whatever cause, it appeared to him better not to taste again. Perhaps the experience had been so complete that repetition would be a vulgarity, like asking to hear the same symphony twice in a day. As he stood pondering over this and wondering how often in his life on earth he had reiterated pleasures not through desire but in the teeth of desire and in obedience to a spurious rationalism, he noticed that the light was changing. It was darker behind him than it had been. Ahead, the sky and sea shone through the wood with a changed intensity. To step out of the forest would have been a minute's work on earth. On this undulating island it took him longer. And when he finally emerged into the open, an extraordinary spectacle met his eyes. All day there had been no variation at any point in the golden roof to mark the sun's position. But now the whole of one half heaven revealed it. The orb itself remained invisible, but on the rim of the sea rested an arc of green so luminous that he could not look at it, and beyond that, spreading almost to the zenith, a great fan of colour like a peacock's tail. Looking over his shoulder, he saw the whole island ablaze with blue, and across it and beyond it, even to the ends of the world, his own enormous shadow. The sea, far calmer now than he had yet seen it, smoked towards heaven in huge dolomites and elephants of blue and purple vapour, and a light wind, full of sweetness, lifted the hair on his forehead. The day was burning to death. Each moment the waters grew more level, something not far removed from silence began to be felt. He sat down cross-legged on the edge of the island, the desolate lord, it seemed, of this solemnity. For the first time it crossed his mind that he might have been sent to an uninhabited world, and the terror added, as it were, a razor edge to all that profusion of pleasure. Once more, a phenomenon which reason might have anticipated took him by surprise. To be naked yet warm, to wander among summer fruits and lie in sweet heather, all this had led him to count on a twilight night, a mild midsummer greyness. But before the great apocalyptic colours had died out in the west, the eastern heaven was black. A few moments, and the blackness had reached the western horizon. A little reddish light lingered at the zenith for a time, during which he crawled back to the woods. It was already, in common parlance, too dark to see your way. But before he had lain down among the trees, the real night had come. Seamless darkness. Not like night, but like being in a coal cellar, darkness in which his own hand held before his face was totally invisible. Absolute blackness, the undimensioned, the impenetrable, pressed upon his eyeballs. There is no moon in that land, no star pierces the golden roof. But the darkness was warm, sweet new scents came stealing out of it. The world had no size now, its boundaries were the length and breadth of his own body and the little patch of soft fragrance which made his hammock, swaying ever more and more gently. Night covered him like a blanket and kept all loneliness from him. The blackness might have been his own room. Sleep came like a fruit which falls into the hand almost before you have touched the stem.